Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Friday, July the 13th. And you can test your knowledge of Wisconsin history this hour and maybe even learn a little something, the stories behind the headlines about events that shaped our state. We will ask you some questions that you can attempt to answer, and we'll hold a drawing at the end of the hour and give away a copy of our guest's book this hour. We will be talking with the author of It Happened in Wisconsin, From the Invention of the Snowmobile to a Historic Packers Win Over the Bears, 30 Events That Shaped the History of the Badger State. We will welcome your questions about some of the historical claims to fame that we have here in Wisconsin. We will wonder what comes to mind to you as one of the most significant events in Wisconsin history. And we will welcome your answers to some of the Wisconsin historical trivia questions that I'll toss out from time to time. No one has yet called in with an answer to the questions I posed at the top of the hour. Do you know if it's true or not that claim that some disgruntled Green Bay Packers fan killed Dan Devine's dog? Is that true or false? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Or who was James McCaffrey, and what historical event is he associated with? Do you know? 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. Well, our guest knows. He is Michael B., a freelance writer. His work has appeared in numerous magazines and newspapers. He is the author of It Happened in Wisconsin, From the Invention of the Snowmobile to a Historic Packers Win Over the Bears, 30 Events That Shaped the History of the Badger State. And he's also the publisher of the website ClassicWisconsin.com. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
How are you?
Well, I'm just fine so far for Friday the 13th.
That's right. I hope it's going to be a lucky day for you.
Well, it's too early to tell right now.
Yeah. 30 events that shape the history of the Badger State. There are a lot of them, I'm sure. How did you whittle it down to 30?
Well, it wasn't easy, believe me. There could be several volumes to a book like this. As your listeners may have gathered by now, this is not a textbook. This is a decidedly popular history of the state of Wisconsin. And the monumental events in the state's history are all included here, such as the Pestrigo Fire and the rise of Bob La Follette. But It Happened in Wisconsin is really the first modern collection I know that includes famous and the obscure, along with the inspirational and the tragic, the important events, as I said, and things that are just plain weird. So it is an interesting and eclectic mix of stories that we included here. And as I said, it was difficult to narrow things down to 30 stories. So Wisconsin has really been blessed in that regard, and we've had our share of interesting and important and quirky events to occur here. So we've been blessed in that regard. Yeah. We've got a remarkable natural history, a remarkable political history, and so I drew a little bit from each area and whittled it down to 30 stories.
Yeah, and I think I did okay in my fourth grade Wisconsin history
right.
class, but I didn't know some of the things that you uncovered here. So you can learn some things too, even if you took a fourth grade history in a Wisconsin classroom.
Yeah, that was that was my intention as well, because many of these stories are familiar to Wisconsin folks. And I wanted to recast them in a way that would be new and fresh and entertaining and instructive as well. And I think I did that. There were some chapters that I surprised even myself, and one in particular where I uncovered some information that sheds new light on an old story. That would be the chapter regarding Jefferson Davis in Wisconsin, and we can talk more about that. But each chapter is a distinct story. It stands in its own.
Let me bring in, one of the stories that you had is from very recent history.
Yeah.
And that was one of the questions I posed just a few moments ago, mm-hmm. about Dan Devine's dog. This is something that when I read it, I didn't know the whole story. You give us the story behind the initial headlines, and I think Ron in Green Bay has a guess on this one. Hi, Ron.
Oh, it's not a guess.
Oh, you know. True or false? Did a disgruntled fan shoot Dan Devine's dog?
Oh, yeah. It was pretty disgusting to hear about, but yeah, they did.
Well, what's the answer, really, Michael B?
Well, the answer is no, but this is one of the great all-time myths coming out of Wisconsin, and it's one of the all-time infamous stories in sports. When Dan Devine died just a few years back, his obituary was carried nationwide because he was a college football Hall of Fame coach. And in his obituary, and I believe that was the year roughly 2000 or so, his obituary referenced the fact that while he was coaching in Green Bay, disgruntled fans had shot his dog. And growing up in Green Bay, this was a story that I had always heard. It's based on a Time magazine story that was written in 1974. But the fact of the matter is, when you look into it, and even Dan Devine himself came clean on the story shortly before his death, the fact is that the dog Dan Devine had was he lived in a rural area. He was prone to letting the dog run free. A farmer who lived nearby Dan Devine warned the coach several times not to let the dog run free because the dog was mixing it up with the farmer's chickens. And after repeated warnings and after the dog got into the chicken coop, farmer took matters into his own hands.
Yeah, and he said that he didn't mean to kill the dog, and apparently you mentioned the farmer was even crying when he brought the dog to Dan Devine's house.
That's right, yeah. That's right. And this is as told in Dan Devine's own autobiography. But the intriguing thing about it is Dan Devine planted this story with Time magazine in 1974 in a really negative story about Green Bay.
Yeah, and we've got a weather forecast to remind listeners of, and we will continue talking with Michael B. about It Happened in Wisconsin. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 19 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Friday the 13th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, Ben's guest will offer a new vision of work in the second half of our lives. That's coming up, I guess, a work past retirement coming up later this afternoon. We are talking about some true tales from Wisconsin's past with Michael B., the author of It Happened in Wisconsin, From the Invention of the Snowmobile to a Historic Packers Win Over the Bears, 30 Events That Helped Shape the History of the Badger State. And we're trying to have a little fun with this, too, offering you some quiz questions that you can attempt to answer. But we also welcome your questions for our guest. Maybe there is a historical event that you think was particularly significant that you would like to share or ask our guest about. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Anyone who participates in the discussion this morning, either by answering a quiz question, even if you answer it wrong, or by asking a question or sending an email, we'll throw everybody's name in a hat at the end of the hour and do a drawing and send our copy of Michael's book to one lucky listener during this hour. It happened in Wisconsin. We just asked our first trivia question, and that was whether or not some disgruntled Green Bay Packers fan really killed former coach Dan Devine's dog. And while it's true someone shot Dan Devine's dog, it's not true that it was a disgruntled fan. So I guess it was sort of a trick question, Michael B. But Dan Devine, actually, you say he did plant the story with Time, though, and let Time report that it was a disgruntled fan.
Yes. In 1974, Dan Devine was on the outs as head coach, and he was determined to take his shots at Green Bay before the end of the season or before he got fired, whichever came first. So he gave an exclusive interview to Time magazine to illustrate all the terrible things about how he was treated in Green Bay. And the case in point was that some fans, disgruntled fans, had shot his dog. And this was a story from that Time magazine story. The story of his dog is something that grew and persisted throughout the years. And never really went away. And as I said earlier, in Dan Devine's obituary, it mentioned that while he was in Green Bay, his dog had been shot by disgruntled fans. When the fact is, Devine personally created that story, gave it to Time magazine, let it metastasize for years, and then in the end, in his autobiography published in the year 2000, came clean and explained what had really happened. But his obituary proved that, you know, when the legend becomes fact, the legend is what often gets printed.
Yeah, and Ron in Green Bay thought it was true. But, Ron, you're still eligible for our drawing. You don't have to have the right answer. Did you say, Michael, that you're a Green Bay native?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, so you you also wrote about this historic Packers win over the Bears. Were you at that game?
I was at that game. Mm-hmm. That was the one event in the book that I personally witnessed. And one of the reasons that I included that in the book is obviously you have to have some Packer stories in here. It just wouldn't be complete mm-hmm. without something related to the Packers. And for my generation, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, the post-glory years, that was a long, long, mm-hmm. difficult period of time of 20 years of mediocrity. And that game came along in 1989, and we're talking about the instant replay game, which is the chapter included in the book. And for my generation, and for the generation that came after the glory years, that was the single shining moment that we had. That was our ice bowl. And I think it was important to include that in the book for that reason. While we all celebrate the glory years of the Packers, it was a lean period of time there in the 70s and the 80s, and there was that one moment. It was the 89 instant replay game against the Bears.
I'm a native of Appleton, and I remember those not so glorious years very well too.
Oh.
and just to get to the punchline of that, the instant replay game, for those of us who don't remember that specific game. And I'm one of them. But Don Majkowski threw a last minute touchdown, but then a referee said he was over the line of scrimmage or something.
That's exactly it. It had been many years since the Packers had beaten their arch rival, the Bears, and it was just a bad time in general for the Packers. They were having off the field problems, and. On November 5th, 1989, they met the Bears in Green Bay, and as you said, it went down to the wire. Don Majkowski threw the winning touchdown pass, but the officials in the first year of using instant replay decided to review it, and they spent 4 minutes reviewing this play, which in pro football terms is an eternity. And I distinctly remember, and folks who watch the game distinctly remember, the players milling around on the field and the official up in the replay booth taking a look at the video and this wait going on and on and on. And eventually they reversed the call and the Packers won the game. But when I went back to research that, the interesting thing to me and the way I the angle I approached it was at the same time, the Cold War was beginning to end, and on the Monday morning after that game, If you looked at any newspaper, the headlines were regarding the lifting of travel restrictions along the Iron Curtain, which signaled the beginning of the end of the Cold War. And this was obviously huge news everywhere. But if you take a look at Wisconsin newspapers, the top of the fold, the headlines, were all about a football game that occurred the day before.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phones. Pat in Brookfield has a question, not an answer. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I guess there's sort of two events from the University of Wisconsin, the Pail and Shovel Party that seemed to be at least famous locally, and that was the Pink Flamingos on Bascom Hill and then the Statue of Liberty, you know, kind of rising up out of frozen Lake Mendota. And I don't know, those seem to signify, you know, wacky student government and irreverence that Wisconsin has. And I don't know, I'm wondering, I guess, if either one of those is in the book.
No, those are not in the book, although those are great ideas. And as you said, that's a great illustration of kind of the irreverence that has taken place on campus at UW-Madison, especially involving the student political parties there. It's not in the book, unfortunately. As I said, hopefully there will be more volumes when we could include this stuff. But by the way, Doug Moe, a columnist for the Capital Times, has done a number of stories on the Pail and Shovel Party. And if you take a look at the Cap Times and look at Doug Moe's archives, you can come across a number of terrific columns regarding the Pail and Shovel Party in Madison, at UW-Madison.
Thanks, Pat. And maybe that will be in the sequel, Michael B.
Let's hope.
There is a story, a much more serious story, that happened on the UW-Madison campus that is in the book, and that's the bombing of Sterling Hall.
Yeah, absolutely. This was something that really kind of stood out as something that needed to be included in the book. And again, the magnitude of this event really cannot be understated. It was considered, even now it's considered to mark the end of the era of the 60s. Kent State is often viewed as being the event that more or less ended the era in the spirit of the 1960s. But many scholars and authors have gone back and looked at the bombing of Sterling Hall and really concluded that it was the bombing of Sterling Hall here in Madison that definitively ended the spirit and the era of the 60s. It occurred in 1970. On the UW-Madison campus, as you had mentioned, and there is a chapter in there dedicated to that.
Well, let's check our news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then see if more listeners want to attempt their luck at our impromptu "It Happened in Wisconsin" quiz. Still looking for the answer to the question: who was James McCaffrey? And what law did his death inspire? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Maybe I should give you a hint. Maybe I should say, what law did his death overturn? And maybe that'll give you a hint. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Do you know Jefferson Davis's connection to Wisconsin? We'll talk about that with Michael B. after the weather, or after the news, that is. Michael B., freelance writer, and also the publisher of the website ClassicWisconsin.com. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Michael B., who is author of the new book, It Happened in Wisconsin, From the Invention of the Snowmobile to a Historic Packers Win Over the Bears, 30 Events That Shaped the History of the Badger State. And we are talking about some of those 30 events and quizzing you a little bit, having some fun with some Wisconsin historical trivia. I have a couple of callers online waiting to answer or at least guess the answer to the questions on the table. One was, who is John McCaffrey and what role did he play in Wisconsin's history? What law did his death inspire? And also, what is Jefferson Davis's connection to Wisconsin? So we have a couple of callers who are waiting to guess on those. And let me put a couple of more on the table for when we're done with that. How about who invented the snowmobile and where? And what city in Wisconsin claims to be the birthplace of the Republican Party? Those might be kind of easy, but what the heck. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, and Madison 263-1890. We don't have a lot of fabulous prizes to give away for correct answers, but what we will do is if you want to, we will throw your name in a hat, and at the end of the hour, we'll pick one winner of everybody who calls in during the hour and send you a copy of Michael Bee's book, It Happened in Wisconsin.
A fabulous prize, isn't it?
But we just have one fabulous prize,
okay.
not several fabulous prizes. Can't give a prize to everyone. We can't give everyone a book because we only have one. So let's take our callers who have, I want to guess. Mike in Waukesha. Hi, you're on the air.
This is Mike?
Yes, Mike. Right.
Yes, Mike. The John McCaffrey, he had the dubious honor of being the last being hanged in Kenosha, the last person to be executed in Wisconsin, which caused Wisconsin to ban capital punishment.
We have a winner. Well, we have someone who's eligible to be a winner. Thank you very much, Mike. Yeah, want to give us a little bit more on that, Michael B. That was a gruesome murder that he was accused of, but maybe an even more gruesome execution.
Yes, he was convicted, rightly so, of murdering his wife, as the caller said, in Kenosha, and this was the year 1851. Now, capital punishment had existed in the Wisconsin territorial days from 1836 to 1848, and it was still on the books after statehood. The McCaffrey case in 1851 left the judge no alternative but to sentence McCaffrey to death. That was not something the judge was pleased that he had to do, but as of the law as it stood in 1851, the judge was required to sentence John McCaffrey to death. And so this was the first execution that took place in the state after Wisconsin had gone from territory to statehood. And the execution was a circus. Thousands of people flocked to Kenosha to watch this, almost as kind of as amusement. The editor of the local Kenosha paper, Lathan Scholes, was appalled by what he witnessed, not to mention that the methods used to execute McCaffrey were very primitive, and the man was not hung in an instant, but he unfortunately suffered for many minutes while dangling above the gallows. And the local newspaper, as I said, led by Lathan Scholes, railed against the execution and devoted a detailed description of what had transpired. And Lathan Scholes, as a result, was elected to the state assembly not long afterward. And as a legislator, he led the death penalty repeal, which was signed into law here in the state in 1853. Making Wisconsin one of the states that I believe the state that has outlawed capital punishment the longest of any in the nation.
Thanks, Mike, for that correct answer. Now let's go to Bill in Lancaster, who has a guess on the Jefferson Davis question. Hi.
Morning. I believe Jefferson Davis was the post commander at Fort Crawford in Prairie du Chien.
Yay!
Very good. He was the lieutenant. He wasn't the commander, and this is what makes the story particularly interesting. The commander at Fort Crawford was Zachary Taylor, who was destined to become the 12th president of the United States. Jefferson Davis was his lieutenant at Fort Crawford, and Jefferson Davis, of course, was destined to become the one and only president of the Confederate States. So the caller is correct. Jefferson Davis served time in Wisconsin at Fort Crawford. He traveled to the other fort, Fort Howard, in Green Bay while he was in Green Bay, or while he was in Wisconsin. And the story behind this is has been often told. In the 1830s, Jefferson Davis was at Fort Crawford serving under Zachary Taylor. Jefferson Davis, while stationed in Prairie du Chien, fell in love with Zachary Taylor's daughter, Sarah. And the story of their courtship has been told many times over the years, with Zachary Taylor being characterized as opposing his daughter marrying a career military man. And that is true. Zachary Taylor did oppose the marriage of the couple for several years. And on a personal level, it seems that Zachary Taylor and Jefferson Davis never really hit it off, although there weren't any reasons why that may have been the case until, I'm happy to say, I came across some new information on this story that sheds an awful lot of light on the relationship going on there. I came across two newspaper articles indicating that Jefferson Davis, while he was in Wisconsin, had married a Winnebago Indian woman and fathered a child while serving in Wisconsin. And this was roughly the same time that he was courting Sarah Taylor, Zachary Taylor's daughter. The obituary of a person named Joe Davis appeared in the Shawano Leader, and it states very plainly that Joe Davis was the son of Jefferson Davis, the father of the Southern Confederacy.
Hmm. Thank you very much, Bill, for calling. Let me, before our weather break, bring on Liz in Milwaukee, who has something else related to Jefferson Davis. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Hi, Liz.
We were visiting in, and I can't think of the little town in Wisconsin where they say they have the bell from Jefferson Davis's plantation hanging.
Oh, yes, I've heard of that. Yes,
yeah.
Because Wisconsin soldiers during the Civil War captured Jefferson Davis right after the ending of the Civil War.
Right.
And that's right. The bell was brought back to Wisconsin.
Here's the thing. We were living in Mississippi at the time and heard about this, and we checked around, and in Mississippi they say that's not true.
Oh.
It's very interesting. And I remember writing a letter to the folks. I can't think of the town. But they actually say that bell, the bell that's being referred to in Wisconsin, is not his bell, that it's just some bell.
Okay.
And that the Wisconsin soldiers just kind of made up a story when they came back to make it seem more exciting. So I don't know the real truth of that, but
interesting.
That's what we experienced, and it was just because we happened to be living there at the time that we looked into it.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. That's very interesting.
No problem.
Liz, thanks very much. Maybe another one for the sequel.
That's right.
Yeah. We don't know the name of this town that's making this allegedly false claim to fame?
No, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I do recall seeing an article about that when I was going through the archives.
All right. We're going to check weather, and then after that, we will find out who invented the snowmobile and where that was. We're still looking for an answer to the question of what city in Wisconsin claims to be the birthplace of the Republican Party. And we'll wonder if that's really accurate or not. And we'll welcome any other questions you have about Wisconsin history. We're talking with Michael B., author of It Happened in Wisconsin, From the Invention of the Snowmobile to a Historic Packers Win Over the Bears, 30 Events That Shaped the History of the Badger State. And I'll page through here and find some more questions to quiz you with. And remember, everybody who calls in with an answer or a question is eligible to win the one copy of Michael B.'s book that we have to give away. We'll do a drawing at the end of the hour. 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. It's about 13 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Friday the 13th. Coming up after 7 o'clock, we will talk about the current backlash against bottled water. Many say we should give up the bottle, can the water, and turn on the tap. because bottled water is not very eco-friendly. We'll talk with a guest who thinks that coming up after 7. Talking with Michael B., author of It Happened in Wisconsin. Here's one more question that I'll put on the table. This is a little bit, kind of gruesome, too. Where can we find a marker in Wisconsin? Where would you find a marker in Wisconsin that refers to, it says this, their cannibalism made them unsatisfactory neighbors. Their cannibalism made them unsatisfactory neighbors. Where would you see that in Wisconsin? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Michael B., let me go to the phones. I said we would talk about who invented the snowmobile. I don't know if we have Vern and Seymour. I'm not sure if he has a guess or not, but Vern, go ahead.
Actually, I had a question about the tracks that it runs on, the caterpillar tracks. I have a story from my father that my grandfather actually invented the snowmobile. And I have a photograph. It's a real crude machine, and apparently he patented the track, not the machine itself. I was curious if you had anything about the tracks.
I understand what you mean by the track. Is that the skis?
No, what propels it on, you know, what moves it,
oh.
Like wheels on a car. I was just wondering how accurate my dad's story was.
Do you know, Michael?
No, I couldn't tell you the answer on that. The patent for the first snowmobiles were made by Carl Eliason, who lived in northern Wisconsin. And like many folks after the turn of the century, Carl tinkered with various sleds and automobiles, putting skis on various machines to try to get them to propel themselves through the Wisconsin winters. Carl Eliason was born with a bad foot, and it denied him the ability to make the treks through the deep snow to hunt and fish, which, of course, he loved to do, as any northern Wisconsin person would. And so he tinkered with a Model T Ford, putting snow skis on it. That at first didn't travel very well. In 1924, he put a small outboard motor on a toboggan along with some skis, and later patented that as the first snowmobile. So it was invented here in northern Wisconsin, up near Saner, Wisconsin, which is very close to the border with the UP. And Carl Eliason's descendants are still in northern Wisconsin. And you can see a lot of those original sleds, the original snowmobiles that Carl Eliason invented.
Vern, thanks very much for the call. James in Oshkosh is going to guess about the Republican Party birthplace question. Hi, James.
Hi. How are you? Great show. Yeah, it's Ripon.
Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
Well,
yeah.
I said it was pretty obvious, and I knew it was kind of an easy one, but there's some dispute to Michael B. as to whether that is indeed true.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of dispute. You don't want to bring this up in Michigan or in other states.
There's got to be, because we're such a Democratic state, so how could this possibly be true?
How could it possibly be true?
Well, it was a meeting was called March 1st, 1854, and this is cited by the Republican National Committee in their official history. Not that the Republican National Committee is the ultimate source on things, but nevertheless, it is mentioned in their official history that the meeting in Ripon, Wisconsin, established the Republican Party. The problem is, there were meetings taking place all over the North in 1854 as opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska Act really exploded. And Alvin Beauvais was one of the countless leaders who was marshaling anti-slavery sentiment in the North, and Alvin Beauvais was a prominent resident of Ripon. So it is accepted, and it is been documented to some extent. A few months after the Ripon meeting, Jackson, Michigan, hosted a Republican Party event. They'll give you an argument that they're the birthplace of the Republican Party. But as it turns out, Alvin Beauvais, who held that meeting in Ripon, founded the name Republican Party and suggested it to Horace Greeley, who was a very famous editor of the New York Tribune at the time. And so Horace Greeley in New York was responsible for promoting the name Republican Party. But Alvin Beauvais had a friendship and a relationship with Horace Greeley, and that's where the name Republican Party emerged.
There's more to the story, too. The actual name of the chapter, and we don't have time because we've got so many callers, your chapter name is funny, Commie Swingers and Republicans, Oh My.
Yes, well, Ripon has a very colorful history, and prior to the establishment of the Republican Party, there was a commune in Ripon. The ironic part is this was a thriving communist location prior to the establishment of the Republican Party.
Thanks, James, for the correct answer. Bill and Eagle is going to give one of the questions a shot. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
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 The one about cannibalism. I believe that referred to the ancient Indian settlement at Aztalan.
We have Correct. Another winner, or at least eligible winner. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, he's absolutely right. And this is a very interesting settlement. And as the caller mentioned, it was an Indian settlement established. Oh, boy, I don't have the time frame here in front of me, but it is an ancient history. I guess sometime around 1100 A.D., a Mississippian Indian village was established near Lake Mills, and this is known as Aztalan. It's been assumed for many years, for a long time, since studies were made of the site, that the residents there were cannibals. It's been, however, refuted by some very recent research conducted in 2005 in a book called Aztalan, Mysteries of an Ancient Indian Town that was produced right here in Wisconsin. It's a terrific book that shows that the folks who lived in Aztalan were not necessarily cannibalistic. There may have been cannibalistic rituals involved in their culture. However, they weren't, true cannibals, you would say.
I'm going to put one more question on the table. Only about 5 more minutes to go, but maybe time to get in another a quiz question here. I'm just going to make this up from memory. I didn't write it down. Who was the lost explorer who discovered Green Bay, and what was he really trying to find? Where was he headed? What did he want to find when he found Green Bay? That's the next question or last question, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Who was the lost explorer who discovered Green Bay, and what was he really trying to find? June in Shawano has another question. Hi, June.
I've got the name, but I can't remember a lost explorer. But I think he was trying to find the Northwest Passage. My question is one may not be so historical, but one that broke the hearts of a lot of people. Is it true that Otis Redding died here on Lake Mendota?
Yes, that is true. Actually, it was Lake Monona, the other Madison lake, and that did happen. His small plane crashed into Lake Monona, and I believe that was 1967, although I don't have a chapter written on that. But yes, that is true. Otis Redding met his death in a plane crash in Lake Monona. And the particularly sad thing about it is he was just on the cusp of stardom. His hit song "Sitting on the Dock of the Bay" did not become a major hit until after his death. He'd recorded the song just a few days prior to his death. So he never lived to see the stardom that was coming.
Yeah, that's thanks, June, for the call. Just a couple of minutes. I think Tom in Eau Claire has an answer or a guess to the Explorer question. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Was the Lost Explorer Nicolet?
Yes.
And yes. What was he trying to find?
He was trying to...
Oh, that's all right. Go ahead, Michael. Yeah.
Well, does the caller have an idea?
No, I do not.
He was trying to find China. The explorers of the early 1600s who worked under Samuel de Champlain were trying to find the people of the sea, which is China, as a matter of fact, the Orient. The explorers of that time frame thought that the Great Lakes were a passage to the Orient, and
well,
so.
Yeah. Yeah.
When he got out of his canoe, he put on a silk robe and fired his pistols in the air, and believing he had potentially reached China.
Well, he was not that close. Anyway, thank you, Michael B. This was fun. A lot of participation. Maybe we can do this again sometime.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Michael B., author of It Happened in Wisconsin, From the Invention of the Snowmobile to a Historic Packers Win Over the Bears, 30 Events That Shaped the History of the Badger State. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and to Christina Taylor for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.